Welcome, everyone, to Potholes and Politics, local Maine issues from A to Z. I'm your co-host, Rebecca Graham.
And I'm Rebecca Lambert. And with us today is our fearless leader, Kate Dufour.
Kate Dufour, the one and only, who happens to be one of my favorite persons in the world. And not just because she signs my paycheck or passes it up to Kathy to sign. But Kate is an inspirational leader. She is the head of advocacy and communications. She's been at MMA since 1995. She's a town counselor in Hollowell. She's a certified assessor.
List goes on.
No, let's see. She has a killer sense of humor, and she's always got her back. So she's one of the best bosses at MMA.
All right, so now I'm blushing. and half of this might be genuine. Because one evaluation is done and the other is not yet, so.
Yeah, I've got till April to keep doing this, right? So Kate is here to talk to us today about the Senior Property Tax Stabilization Program that has been amended this year to be a better law, to dig into how we got to the new approach to property tax stabilization. We should talk about what happened last year in LD 290.
Yeah, so last year, LD 290 was enacted at the 11th hour with very little notice being put to anyone who might be impacted by it. It came out of the taxation committee in the first session with an ought not to pass majority, but ended up winding its way to the appropriations table. And as the legislature was getting ready to adjourn in 2022, the Republicans decided to fund the program because it had a very low fiscal note, roughly $50,000 to get Maine Revenue Service's additional staff. Wow. And so really no thought or analysis was done with respect to the cost of the program moving forward.
And LD 290 essentially froze everyone's property taxes if they were 65 or older.
Correct. If you were 65, there were other parameters, and a very complicated law was written in a paragraph. It's basically a paragraph which says if you're 65 years of age or older and you have owned a home in the state of Maine for 10 years, not necessarily consecutive years, then you would qualify for the benefit of freezing your taxes, your tax rate. So if your obligation to the community was $5,000, then that would be, you would cap out. So if next year the taxes went up to $6,000, you'd still get the reprieve of $5,000. We were told by individuals who enacted the legislation that it would be very easy to administer, and that was completely false. Assessors spent thousands of hours processing applications and doing the verification work. So you could have lived in Maine in the 1980s, gone to Florida a few years, and then come back. And so it was incumbent upon the assessors to actually illustrate that somebody had actually lived in the state of Maine and owned a home in the state of Maine for 10 years. Because absent that due diligence, then the community would really put its reimbursement on the line. So the communities, the assessors had to do the work. They were being hounded. There were two other complicating factors. One was that it was an annual application process. So residents would have to apply annually for the benefit of keeping their tax frozen at that initial rate. If you skipped a year, you were reset. So you could be in the program for 10 years, accidentally get sick, maybe you're in the hospital, you miss the deadline, and suddenly you're mill rate, or not your mill rate, but your tax rate or your tax commitment skyrockets. Now, they're not going to blame the Maine State Legislature who enacted this law. They're going to blame municipal officials, the assessor, the tax collector, you name it. So it was very well designed to allow the legislature to pat itself on the back for delivering property tax relief, but putting all the burdens and the public relations nightmares on municipal officials. And the other complicating factor was portability. So you could, and I get it, this is the extreme example and everybody uses it, you could have a mobile home in a really rural community, freeze your tax obligation at $500, and then buy a $1 million mansion in Kennebunkport, for example, and your tax obligation would be $500.
Wow.
So it really put It put property tax dollars at risk. And the most frustrating part of all of this is that there was no discussion with municipal officials. Legislators who have never held, in most cases, have never held public office are deciding how property taxes should be used, and it just doesn't work.
So I have a question. So in that situation that you talked about, where they would go to Kennebunk and buy a house and have their taxes frozen at $500, wouldn't it stay with that property? Like, wouldn't, if they bought a new property in Kennebunk, wouldn't they have to pay the taxes on that property?
What the law did was allowed you to take your tax liability with you.
Oh, the portability.
You.
Okay,
you could take that anywhere. Part.
So owning a home, not necessarily being a resident of Maine.
No, I think you had to be a resident of Maine because there was a link between the eligibility standards under the homestead exemption. So,
okay.
I mean, you had to be a homeowner in the state of Maine.
And going through a process that kind of vets someone's individual ability or residential history, is that something that's a normal assessor role?
Not normally. It's limited right now under the homestead exemption. You have to have owned your home for a year before you can qualify. So there was some element of familiarity with that assessment process or eligibility and verification process. But 10-year look back, not consecutive, is a lot of work. I mean, you could have lived in 5 different communities in the state of Maine. So the assessor was connecting with 5 different assessors to say, hey, did John Smith really own a home and live in that home, you know, in 1985?
Or multiple homes.
Correct.
Yeah. So there are a number of, I had heard anecdotally that there were some folks that were waiting for their tax bill to decide which place they were going to claim residency for this.
I think there was a lot. I mean, when you, particularly in the tax committee, and I'm sure it happens in other committees, when you talk about human nature, nobody believes you, right?
Yeah.
So several times, you know, we've talked about tax lien foreclosure and the return of excess sales revenue. And prior to the Supreme Court getting, U.S. Supreme Court getting involved, we'd make the argument that if there isn't a penalty of loss of home, people have no obligation. There's nothing that drives the need to pay property taxes. If you can just say, I'm done, town, you sell my house and give me my revenues back. And when you make that argument, people were incensed. Oh, people would never do that. Well, if people were up and up and honest, we wouldn't have boatloads of statutes either. So it's hard to fight these bills because everybody's an angel when you're trying to defend against a very generous tax benefit.
Yeah, ironically, that goes over into motor vehicle registrations as well.
Yep.
And those are the only sticks that municipalities have, and they're not very quick either. They provide ample opportunity for someone to pivot.
I mean, if you look at the tax lien foreclosure process, I mean, you're talking from start to end easily 3 years and multiple notices. I mean, there's, with the exception of acquiring property for a public purpose, you know, a park or a parking garage or whatever the community might need, municipalities are not eager to take this property because for the most part, and I would probably say 95%, it's not property that anybody wants. It's been neglected. Mm-hmm. In some cases, there's asbestos. Now PFAS is the new thing. Heat has been off for years. No sewer, no water. They're not beautiful properties. So.
No, nor are they selling for boatloads of money either. And they often have a cleanup element, which the municipality ends up having to be the agent for that.
In some cases, municipalities just won't foreclose. I mean, it's just not worth it. Just ride it out.
And then in some cases, you have tenants you have to worry about.
Yeah, that's... And again, it's the tough love side of local government. You don't want to be responsible for a tenant. You don't want to be a landlord as a municipal entity. And so sometimes you have to do the hard thing and kick people out of their homes. And then again, that's a splash in a newspaper without any thought or research or...
context.
Yeah, with respect to what the law is and does. And the thing that's never said or mentioned is that all this time that this individual hasn't pay their taxes. And there are people who cannot pay their taxes. There's too much of a burden placed on property taxes to fund municipal government services. But long-winded way of saying that when you don't pay your share, somebody else does. And so you got other families, you have other businesses in the community that are also struggling, who are now paying more than their fair share because somebody else can't or won't.
And that was kind of one of the bigger issues, too, because it wasn't means tested. You could have a mansion, your tax would be frozen. You could take that, you could add on to that property several other buildings, and your assessment would never increase. And you were not taxed for that, those additions or expansions, and then you could take that assessment and apply it someplace else. So it wasn't means tested and wouldn't actually target the individuals that really need that property tax relief.
Yeah, I mean, just because you're 65 doesn't mean you can't pay your taxes. I mean, people are living longer, we're working longer. You know, if you're sitting on the coast in a, what, $5 million home, I might suggest that you don't need the relief that, you know, I'm a good French woman that Mémé on the hill needs. My point with respect to two approaches is, yes, you needed to target it. And if the state was really interested, and this had a fiscal note of $15 million in the 15 million in the first year, and I think it was 31 in the second year, you know, $31 million could really do a lot for a smaller subset of the population of the state of Maine. Mm. Because CEOs of Fortune 500 companies probably don't need that property tax relief. And when you think about the capping of taxes, they would get bigger value, right?
Right.
So larger property, more expensive property in a very highly valued area of the state, you're paying some really big taxes for that privilege. There's a privilege associated with that. So, you know, the older couple who's living modestly in a community with a mill rate of 10 will not get much of a benefit, while somebody with a large property, a very valuable property, gets far more of a benefit because of the cost.
And arguably that would probably drive up the mill rate as well on those other properties. Because was it returned, or was the intent to return the funds to municipalities at the full value?
Yes.
Or was it half?
Okay. No, so that was the other part of the bill. And this is the legislature gambling with property tax dollars. They do it all the time. They provide the benefit and they leave everybody else in the community to worry about it. Under Maine's constitution, the legislature is required to reimburse municipalities not less than 50% of the cost of a mandate. Of an exemption. So if a municipality loses $100 because of a property tax exemption, then the state is required by constitution to reimburse $50 to the community. What this legislation did, it said that the state would reimburse 100%. That 100% is a huge gamble, because at any point in time, the legislature could revert to its constitutional minimum, which is 50%. So, and we, you know, you could see it. I mean, if something is going to increase by over 100% in a year's time, you can see. I mean, you just do the math. I mean, there are very smart people who get paid a lot of money to do those projections. And within a couple years, the state would not have been able to afford its 100% reimbursement promise, and we'd be back at 50%. And that's when you start seeing state policies conflicting, because there's a big drive for affordable housing. There's a big drive to bring young families into the state. Well, that would have been a direct impact on those families, because that's who's left paying taxes at that point.
Right. Everything would be infinitely more unaffordable. Yes, and the property tax policy that gets set that we constantly hear everyone complain about is way less in the municipal control than it is as a result of the state requirements. So that's something that's not often understood.
Yeah, and I think the element of that is the legislature has, how many committees, 13, 15?
17
standing committees, which all make decisions in silos. And so, you know, the ENR, Environmental Committee, could be saying, well, you know, this is only a $2 impact on you know, each property owner. But if every other community is doing, excuse me, committee is doing something that is increasing the property tax burden by $2, it adds up. And there's no reconciliation at the end of a session to say, this is how much burden we have placed or we're thinking about placing on the property taxpayers. Are we sure we want to do this?
Yeah.
That would be nice if they did that.
It would be nice.
Seems like a very common sense thing to do.
So that went into effect back in May, and the governor did not sign it. It became law without the governor's signature. So this year, there were multiple bills that were put in to try to correct all of the problematic elements, I guess, of this law. So can you tell me about how that process went, maybe some of the approaches that were initially thought of to correct some of those issues, and then what actually happened? So what we've got now.
So I think of there were probably a half a dozen solutions offered, and they fell in two camps. One was to make the process easier. And you saw, I think, at least two, maybe three bills that would have repealed the annual application process. And our members, particularly our assessors, were like, if you do nothing else, do this. Because, you know, again, hundreds of hours, thousands of hours spent on these applications. I get it. Subsequent applications might be a little easier, a renewal to do. But still, there's that due diligence because, again, 100% reimbursement was online. So our assessors were basically saying, we need this. And then the other batch of fixes were focused on limiting the delivery of the benefit to those most in need. And MMA, as well as Senator Bennett, had a similar approach, which was to target relief via increases to the homestead exemption based on age. The MMA approach not only based it on age, but also income. So to the extent that you fell in below a certain income level, you received an additional benefit under the homestead exemption. So that's where the proposals were coming in. Maine Revenue Services, the association, and the tax committee worked really hard on finding a solution. And at the end of the day, Maine Revenue Services deserves a load of credit for their work they did, because they ended up expanding two state-implemented and funded programs to better direct property tax relief to those most in need. It did exactly what we wanted, which was to get us out of it. Mm-hmm. If the legislature wants to bestow benefits, they should be administering, implementing, and funding. Leave us out of it. Let us collect our property taxes. You have a relationship with the homeowner. Again, leave us out of it. And so they did two things. One was to expand the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program, which is a program that allows qualifying seniors, it's based on age, assets, and income, to defer payment of taxes. The community is held whole because the state becomes the property taxpayer, pays the municipality, and files a non-foreclosing lien. So there's no threat of loss of property for not paying those taxes. And when the individual is no longer eligible for the benefit, then the state offers the property back to the owners or the heirs. And if they can't do that, then they sell the property. So it's a good way of deferring the taxes and keeping people in their homes, giving them a little bit of help while, you know, maybe they age out or try and figure out the next stage of life. The other program is the Property Tax Fairness Credit, which is an income tax credit. So it's not an offset to the taxes owed. It's an actual credit. So you're paid. Mm-hmm. The law divides it up. There's a benefit that's associated under 60, and maybe it's 65, and then for older Maine residents that provides some benefit, again, some cash back to the eligible individual. And they expanded that to provide benefits to the older crowd were expanded benefits to the older crowd. And there was a lot of pushback on that approach because you have to apply or you have to file income taxes. And yeah, many low-income people do not have to file income taxes, and they don't. You know, we always talk about pandemic silver linings.
Yes.
And so this was one of them where the $850 relief checks, and then there was another, was it a $400 check, you know, maybe a year ago? You had to file for it. It didn't come to your mailbox. You actually had to file income taxes in order to get the benefit. So there's a new population of residents in the state of Maine that are accustomed now to filing taxes, if not just for that benefit. Right. And a lot of that money has been left on the table with respect to the property tax fairness credit because my parents didn't file. I'm sure your mother didn't file.
I had to spend a lot of time convincing her that it was not shady that she was getting money back because I filed her taxes for her.
And that's just it, yeah. Right? So there was a lot of money that's sitting there, right? They appropriate the money, and it goes to back to undesignated surplus revenue because people didn't take advantage of it. And so this, I think, there's a public campaign element of this that, you know, there are people who are now accustomed, so to speak, to applying for filing income taxes and should continue to do so they can benefit. There's money sitting there for very needy people, and you might as well take advantage.
I think one of the things that I thought was extremely progressive and intelligent about the way that they rolled out those two laws is that you can be in that deferral program not needing to pay those property taxes at this point in time and still get the property tax fairness credit. So you're still getting a significant portion of your property tax bill back. And I think that that is wonderful because I think that would help those folks that are in that position that can't pay those property taxes because they're still getting funds when you could be buying oil. So their homes are going to stay heated. If you have a broken window or a leaking roof, you're going to have a chunk of money now that isn't that you're not paying out on property taxes, but it is already assumed that they'll be getting them back.
Yeah.
So it can have the effect that of going back into that home and helping that person.
Absolutely. And kudos to the Mills Administration and Maine Revenue Services because they were very clear about that. That was their idea. Not only are we going to pivot towards the state-funded, administered, implemented programs, we're going to allow people to apply or qualify for both. And their point was eventually you need to pay your taxes at the end of the day.
They're getting it back from a sale. They're getting it back from the estate. Yeah.
So that was forward thinking. And to your point, Rebecca, I agree. I mean, it keeps the lights on. It keeps the heat on. Food on the table. So it's one way to help those most in need. And I think and maybe this is, you know, the Aroostook County upbringing, right? We were always taught that you share, regardless of what it is. You share money. If you have enough, you share money. If you have skills, you share them. And it feels like we're walking away from that moral obligation to care. And, you know, this is maybe bringing this back. I mean, we're reverting from, everybody deserves the same treatment when it comes to property taxes. It's not necessarily true. To a program that's really targeted, and it, you know, relies on those of us who can to help fund these programs through an income tax credit. I'm an old softie. Don't tell members of the legislature.
We won't.
I think I'm awful.
Yes, I think the Imperial Death March is what happens when we walk into the room. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of okay with that.
Me too.
Because that's the meme. I'm here for meme.
Yeah, that's right.
We are the three battle-hardened warriors this past session. It seems like a debrief might be a good idea. What was your biggest shock takeaway, I guess, of this past legislative session from previous legislative sessions? You've done this for a long time. And I think every year we keep saying, my God, it was horrible. But I think there are degrees of horribleness that advances. This is one. That was one, like, really guiding light. I didn't have any of those. So I'm wondering if it's just me or...
No. This has been, and to your point, I mean, we do these legislative updates for affiliate groups. And every year I stand in front of, you know, managers and tax assessors and, you know, treasurers. And I say, this is the weirdest session. But this year was just interesting. And it was so weird that even other lobbying groups were saying what we've said for years, right? So we're municipal government, we're treated you know, as interest group rather than a partner. And I think all of these other lobbying entities have never had that treatment. And this year they got it. I mean, the business community got it. The hospital community got it. The insurance community got it. We all got a taste of what it's like to be on the other side of the legislature. You know, nobody was a darling this year. And it's just, there's some weird, this makes me an awful human being, satisfaction that we were all mistreated. It's just like, at least it's not just us. No. I mean, you know, the individuals who are elected to the Maine State Legislature are good people, right? I mean, you volunteer, you do this stuff. But I think there is a lack of understanding of what their jobs are. I mean, they're there to represent their districts, their communities, their area. There seems to be a lack of understanding of what local government is, what it's designed to do, what it can do, its funding limits. And it's just, this group seemed to be really disconnected from good public policy making, which requires, it requires consensus, it requires hard work, it requires sitting down and saying, okay, I hear you don't like this, but you like this. You know, finding that compromise, and I didn't see it this year. There was a lot of my way or the highway. And I think it's because the extremes, both left and right, those voices are so loud right now that the moderates in the middle are just being steamrolled. I mean, the horror stories that we heard in the halls, and this is, you know, it's gossip, but the way members of parties were being treated by their own peers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you don't hear that. And you had, you know, really well-meaning human beings who are trying their hardest, like absolutely distraught because they're being whipped into shape. Yeah. Don't mean that in a negative way, but, you know, you have the leaders and that's their job, to put people, line people up. It got so bad that people were willing to share those stories of abuse, right? Yeah. I mean, it was just, it's, you feel badly. Just, it's just like high school. It's the mean girls. Yeah. And you don't deserve that in high school. You don't deserve that as a high-functioning adult who's volunteering their time. It's just, I guess the federal government is an example, right? It's trickling down. And it's just like, why can't we just figure out what we need and work to it? You don't need credit for everything. Just figure something out.
Yeah, the zero-sum political game is really bad for public policy in general. Because, when I heard those stories, they were not individuals that were against the policy that was being advanced. They were saying, yes, but we have to fix these problematic elements, because it was the delivery of that policy that was going to be completely screwed up if they didn't. And that was disheartening, because I think ultimately, we don't want palm card stuff. We want functional policy. That's a victory to hand out and hang up if you're going to run again as well.
Right, that we can implement, right?
Yeah.
So 290 is a perfect example. Yes, delivering property relief, tax relief, is of utmost importance. You ask any municipal official and they'll tell you that. I mean, in Hollowell, we're in the process of adopting our budget, and we are looking for every penny so that we can reduce the burden on the property taxpayers.
Yeah.
But we have to provide these services. I mean, if another individual at the state says, you know, it's out of control local government spending, please come to Hollowell. Here's my budget. We have a 22 mil rate right now. 11 of it is for schools and counties, completely out of our control.
Yeah.
Here's the 11 we're raising for municipalities, for the municipal side. What do you want us to cut? The library? Police, public works, you choose.
Right.
You tell me what's out of control.
Same in Reedfield.
But then ask the residents what they want more funded.
Exactly.
And it's not going to be, the priorities aren't going to light up.
Right. So it's that frustration. I don't know how I got on this tangent, but worst podcast ever.
No.
But it's just, I think that's the frustration. There's really no real understanding of local government. And I'm going to put our county and school colleagues in the same boat with us. I mean, it's just they don't get what we are. I mean, there's so many things that you require us to do and then are upset when we raise the money to do it. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Now I know where I was going. God, again, worst podcast ever.
Nope.
Looping back around to the whole worst session and that weird mean girl dynamic, BDN did an exceptional job and took a huge risk. And again, they deserve kudos for FOIA-ing the text messages.
Oh, yeah.
That's an excellent example. There's proof of what's going on. You know, just people. I mean, and I get it, that's the process, but it doesn't have to be that way. When somebody is conflicted with a moral issue, you don't exploit it, right? That's tough to take, but it's a good illustration of what's happening behind closed doors.
Yeah, for me, actually, it was kind of twofold, building upon what you said. One is the inability to advance decent public policy because it was too complicated and couldn't be distilled down into a soundbite. Also, lack of understanding that when you're prescribing something that municipalities already have the power to do, you're actually taking away the ability for those municipalities to be really creative beyond that. You're not telling them something that they can't already do. They're not doing it for specific reasons. So maybe it's because they don't have enough resources. But you dictating how that happens doesn't work in every community because not all of those communities are the same. Mm-hmm. Not all of them have the same access to resources. Not all of them have the same taxpayers that can afford that activity or are going to draw anything to those communities as a result of that activity. So I think that we're seeing that within the housing realm. There are communities that could be really creative. And by prescribing them how they had to handle their land use ordinances, we've got a whole bunch of other unintended consequences because no one actually has sat on a planning board, looked at those lot-by-lot applications and said, well, how the hell do I do this? You know, it's a legally non-conforming lot, and they're allowed a 30%. But is this waterfront? Like, they don't know that function, but they've got a grand idea, and this is going to solve it all. So there's that disconnect between municipal reality and the tools, the actual decent, amazing function tools that home rule provide, and the creative ways that municipalities can imply that gets restricted every single time it becomes prescribed in its delivery.
Well, I'll take us on like a really wicked tangent here on housing. I was at the Managers Institute yesterday and just, you know, hanging out with the managers who, they have tough jobs. But we were talking about affordable housing and the fact that in a market-driven society, it's going to be very difficult to convince somebody to build a unit that they can get $700 worth of rent on rather than sell it for $260,000.
Exactly.
You know, just the inside, they own the outside. But somebody was talking about incentives. And in other countries, the incentive to encouraging more dense development is through the property taxes, where you can have your 5 acres mm-hmm. and build one unit on it. But the taxes are much, much higher
exactly.
if you build a 10 unit. You know, you have one apartment, one building with 10 units. Your property tax obligation plummets because you're doing a public service at
yeah.
that point. And I think that's fascinating. I think in Maine it would take a constitutional amendment. But man, what a great, great process, right? You're directly providing an incentive and encouraging that type of development rather than coming down and saying, you shall. So I think that's, and it gets back to your point, Rebecca, that if we actually took time to think and research and develop models and, you know, take the chips off. And, you know, I'll admit it. I have my own chips. I go into rooms with my own biases, and I go in swinging sometimes.
Yeah.
But if we could, just for a second, just sit and talk about the policy and take time, take 2 years, take 3 years, we might have better outcomes that we don't have to fix year in and year out. I mean, that's what we're in the position of doing now. We rush and adopt legislation. It makes us feel good. And then we spend 2 years trying to fix. So resources could be better spent if we got it right the first time.
Yeah, and sometimes that isn't quick.
Right.
But it allows for public consultation as well. And I think the only role in within housing for government in general is to be the disruptor for those market forces, and we have to figure out how to do that not by, you know, allowing those market forces to roll us over,
correct,
but to say, okay, how can we use the tools like the TIF proposal that we had that would allow us to actually help somebody improve, like Mount Vernon? Everything's for sale right there. Once those flip and you've actually brought those buildings up to code and to make them rentable, that is no longer going to be an affordable street. That is no longer going to be, those triple deckers are going to be big luxury apartments, and they're going to be 2,000-3,000.
And they're gorgeous in their own right.
Exactly.
I mean, they're huge.
Massive.
And they're, you know, wood floors and historic. I mean,
yeah. Really great moldings.
Yeah.
Attention
to
details. And
beautiful.
Big center rooms, and then everything's off of that. Yeah. That was my first apartment. Not on Mount Vernon, but.
Yeah, my brother had
it. It was a
apartment.
Big triple decker.
Yep.
And it was awesome.
Coolest houses.
Connor could ride his bike through it. This is so big. It was so big.
It was great.
And because I wouldn't let him out because he's going to get hurt. So fresh newbie.
Yes.
Rebecca,
yes.
Lambeau. What was your take on your own?
Well, geez. I was...
giggly one. Like, yay.
I was excited. But I would definitely echo what you both have said about the bullying and the feel of the air down there. I was expecting one thing, and it wasn't what I was expecting at all. But I'm still excited. I don't know what that's worth.
It's good. We should actually start a time limit and see how long it takes her to be jaded and.
Well, we have another member now, too. So.
I think she might already come with some jadedness.
You're never going to avoid the being jaded. I mean, it's the nature of our jobs. It's hard to deliver unpopular or unwanted news. But for me, what makes this worthwhile and easy and makes me, you know, gets me up in the morning is our members.
Right.
At the end of the day, I mean, these are good human beings who are doing really good work, and makes it easier to deal with the kind of the BS over there when you keep your members in mind. I mean, we're not
self advocating.
That's right. That's right.
No, I think when our members reach out, I feel better, but I think I feel worse when I can't deliver for them and own way too much. So you feel better about it, and I'm like, shit, I didn't get anything done, so I feel like crap.
This is not right. I think we're very fortunate that our policy committee, the members on our policy committee, as well as the municipal population generally, get it.
Yeah.
They understand what we're up against.
Yeah.
And they see it at home. So it's, you know, we're not going to win them all, and
I think
they understand that. And we made tremendous strides, I think, this year in this environment.
Yeah, I still would like at least 2 solid months to stare at the wall, not to continue to do this. Testimony this week. No rest for the wicked.
No.
So, Becky, where are we in Maine next?
We are headed to Eastport in September. I'm going to check out the Pirate Festival. And I was reading that the Quoddy Tides is a newspaper that was started by a family that is from Eastport. So I've reached out to the editor to see if I can interview him, and hopefully we'll have a little clip for the podcast. And
oh, that'll be awesome.
Yeah. So I'm hoping he gets back to me.
That's cool.
Yeah. It'll be fun. I really am enjoying this series too. It's a lot of fun to research these places, and I'm trying to pick places that I don't know much about, so I can. Although I had to go talk to the manager in my town of Reedfield, and he was like, "Oh, I was hoping to see Reedfield in there," and I was like, "Nope, it's too obvious. Can't do Reedfield. Maybe in a future episode."
That was definitely therapy. Aroostook was therapy for me, and I think that is when I actually get my positive feedback loop, is when I go out and talk to our members and talk to folks and go into those communities. Then I'm like, oh, okay. I feel better.
Yeah, Aroostook was definitely a good time.
It was the same feeling at the Managers Institute yesterday. Just You know, everybody is in a safe environment, talking about issues, and it's just nice to be around these people. It's like that. It's like, yeah, this is a good group to be a part of.
So. Yeah, it's very, very good. And it's the same with NLC. So I know that it's not just us. Yeah. We heard pretty loudly that all of the other leagues are dealing with trying to actually educate legislators for the first time. This is a big thing. Municipal government was the stepping stone for state government. And now they find that they're spending way more time educating on what municipal government is to people who are elected to the state legislature. So a bit like, I guess, a department head for a new committee that is now oversight for their department at the state level that has to educate them about what that department actually does.
Yeah. It'd be nice if we could get in front of the legislature for a, you know, a municipal 101. You know, this is what local government is. We're your partners. We're not the enemy.
Can we set something up in the Hall of Flags, like a municipal caucus day? Something? Can we do stuff like that?
I think we can. The expectation is that, you know, we'll buy lunch and things like that. That we can't do. But Rebecca has done some work in the past on particular issues where, you know, here's a law enforcement issue. Let's bring members of the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee in to meet with law enforcement officials. Well, no, law enforcement leadership and municipal town and city managers and talk about the issues. So I think we can build. And Rebecca, you're talking about building on that platform on, you know, not a case, but an issues basis.
Yeah.
It's your idea. Go ahead. I'll start taking over your podcast.
I wanted, since we started, to have you on this podcast, and you've denied all the time. No, I'm not going to be on the podcast. You guys do the podcast. So I'm going to exploit the fact that you're here. It's taking shape, and it keeps evolving, but we're hoping to bring back the municipal caucus and have some maybe permanent legislators that are interested in doing that. And I think we have a couple that might be interested in doing that so that they can actually encourage some of those conversations and maybe have some folks on a, you know, weekly or maybe monthly basis over there, municipal caucus day, and hear a bunch of issues that have you've heard this week. Ask us questions about how that works. Mm-hmm. Be there as a resource with some folks that have some time and some desire in it, but also have some issues-based views. And I've started the municipal solid waste gathering of groups of stakeholders in that to try to protect all of those regional relationships and maybe do things to help all of them, like change battery recycling or something. That's something that everybody can get behind, and then focus on that as opposed to kind of pitting southern Maine against northern Maine and rural Maine against cities and disadvantaging one for the benefit that someone sees as theirs, which maybe is where home rule can come into play. Maybe we can use home rule for more of those localized needs as opposed to...
Well, Kathy Conlow, our executive director, former manager of Bangor and before that, Orono, she makes a really good point with respect to not all communities are alike. But her point is Hollowell gets to be Hollowell and Reedfield gets to be Reedfield because Augusta is Augusta.
Mm-hmm.
So each community has a role to play because it's not... Because we need a variety of different services. We need a variety of different recreational, entertainment opportunities. So there's, you know, somebody is providing all the services, which allows, you know, Hollowell to be kind of a freaky little fun place.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's dead on, actually. And I would argue we're the same because we're more of a bedroom community adjacent to the tourist area. So we get a lot of benefit from that, and we have a nice place to live as a result of that, too. So,
and that's, I think, one of the issues the legislature really didn't recognize when we were talking about all this housing, is that people want to live in a bedroom community. It may not be your gig, but it's somebody else's gig. That's where they want to be. I live in a very densely develop neighborhood. I like that. I can walk to the downtown. That's not for everybody, though. And I think we miss that. And we've made character a bad word. But it's part of all our land use processes. It's in state
statute. It's part of our neighborhoods.
That's
we create it, whether or not it's at the municipal level.
Exactly. I mean, to your point, yeah, neighborhoods vary from, you know, from street to street. And it's just, we don't want to be cookie cutters, right? We don't want to be just a cookie. We want to be a cookie with sprinkles or really good frosting. So, or combo.
With ice cream.
I was just going to say that.
All right. We've got the convention coming up.
Yes,
and we'll be plopping in some stuff about that soon. So stay tuned for that. And I think that's about it for this week. So
there we are then.
See you next time, Lambo.
See you next time, Grambo.
And thanks, Katie.
You're welcome.